This is The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. Shortly after the 19th century explorers of the American West sent back their reports saying there were vast tracts of land ripe for settling, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation was created to make that settlement possible by distributing water from the big rivers like the Colorado and the Columbia. This massive distribution system is made up of large-scale projects that include huge dams and thousands of miles of canals and pipelines. Today, the Bureau of Reclamation is the largest wholesaler of water in the West, providing drinking water and irrigation for one-third of the population, some 31 million people and 10 million acres of farmland. The Bureau of Reclamation is visible and present in our lives in the West. But Dan Beard, who used to be the commissioner, the main guy of the Bureau of Reclamation, thinks it's time to get rid of the agency entirely. And he's advocating for tearing down some of the monuments of the Bureau's heyday, the large dams that are as iconic to the West as sagebrush and cactus. He's packaged these ideas in a new book called Deadbeat Dams. I talked to Dan Beard earlier this month when he visited Utah State University as part of his book tour.
Well, my name is Dan Beard, and I've written a book called Deadbeat Dams, Why We Should Abolish the Bureau of Reclamation and Tear Down Glen Canyon Dam. I had a long history of working in Washington, D.C. on water resource matters, both in the Congress and in the executive branch, and I served in a lot of different political positions, appointees. I was an appointee of President Carter and President Clinton. And about 10 years ago, I became concerned about the direction of Western water policies, and I began to formulate in the back of my mind a book, and a book really focused for the general public as opposed to water practitioners and water wonks. And I wanted to write a book that the general public could pick up and they could understand what is going on, why it's going on, what impact it has on them personally, and what we can do to change the course of things. And so that's the nature of the book. It tries to recount how we're using and misusing federal dollars and an agenda of things that we really ought to try to address and why those things will help improve the way we manage water in the entire United States, but also in the West.
I read that you saw the Damnation film that Patagonia produced about dam removal, that you saw that in Utah when you were
I did.
Here?
Last March, I was asked to come out to participate in a conference in Salt Lake, which I did. And as I came out, they asked me if I would be kind enough to introduce the film Damnation to an audience at a movie theater, one of the movie theaters in Salt Lake. And I said, sure, I fully expecting that when I went in the room, there would be 10 people there as old as I am and with Birkenstocks. And it turned out that when I went in the room, every seat was filled. Students were sitting in the aisles, standing along the side and in the back. And you could have knocked me over with a feather because every person there was under 35. I was astounded. I didn't know there were that many young people interested in water issues and particularly water policy reform and dam removal. And so it really stuck with me. For the next couple of months, I thought about that and I kept coming back to it thinking there are people out there who care about this and they're young and energetic. And so the one thing I could do for them would be to lay out an agenda of things. Here are the things that we really ought to be working on based on my 40-year career working on water issues. And so that's one of the reasons I wrote the book.
How far along were you in the idea of the book when you saw the film?
I finished a manuscript a couple of years ago, but then I decided it wasn't the right time and I couldn't, it just wasn't right. And so the manuscript sat for several years. And it was only this last summer that I dusted it off, updated, revised it, and then sent it off to a publisher.
So the ideas that you propose in Deadbeat Dams about getting rid of the Bureau of Rec and also getting rid of some dams, among other things, which we'll get into. But I wanted to know, it sounds like you had a lot of these ideas when you were at the Bureau of Reclamation. Has anything changed, and do you feel like you have sort of more power to reform water policy sort of as the author of this book than you did when you were at the head of the organization? Or kind of what is the difference between your two, I guess, the positions that you're in to promote water change?
Well, where you stand on an issue often depends on where you sit. And today I'm a retired federal official. I don't plan to work for anybody in the future other than myself. And so it's easier to write a book and say what you want in that book if you don't have to worry about a future career. It makes it a lot easier. I wanted to be the commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation. I lobbied for the job. You have to put on a campaign and get people to support you to get the appointment. And I did, and I wanted the job. And I wanted the job because I wanted to change the organization from the inside out. Once I got the job, I did make a lot of changes. I reduced the number of employees. I rechanged the focus. I changed the emphasis of the kinds of projects that we undertook. I changed our budget. I did a lot of things. And I thought that those changes were permanent, and I thought those changes would be lasting. And I was wrong. They weren't. As soon as I left, they really receded back into the typical civil engineering, monument building kind of world. I always referred to them when I was with employees. I always said to them, we're an environmental organization, and we need to think about things in those ways. Once I left, they became a civil engineering organization and that wanted to build monuments again. So about 10 years ago, I just concluded that, you know, it isn't going to work. We can't change the organization from within. And the only way we're going to make a lasting difference is to abolish the organization, to get rid of it. I say that reluctantly and a little sadly, because I've spent much of my career trying to make it a different organization and to make a change. But I couldn't do it, and I don't think anybody else can either. So I think the best thing to do is to abolish the organization and take the parts that are meaningful and need to be carried out by a federal employee and allow those to be done by somebody else.
So what are the main kind of mandates of the Bureau of Reclamation? So I guess if we're going to talk about abolishing it, we should talk about what they do and who's going to do it.
Well, the number one thing they were created for was to help settle the West. And they did, you know, high five and a fist bump. The second reason they were created is that there was, at the time, in the early 1900s, no residual of engineering talent and expertise in either the private sector or the public sector to be able to build facilities. So you needed a federal agency to do that. That's no longer the case. We have a vibrant private sector that can build anything, and our highways and other public works projects are all done by the private sector and by local governments. So the Bureau of Reclamation doesn't do anything that can't be done by somebody else. Well, if that's the case, why do you need them? A lot of them will say, well, you need us to run dams and projects. And the answer to that is no, we don't. Somebody else can do that just as well. They're the largest wholesale water supply utility in the United States, and they're probably one of the top 10 power producers. But those don't have to be federal responsibilities. Those can all be done by private sector, state or local governments where those facilities exist. So we will need a few federal officials to make some decisions. But in terms of turning the valves, flipping switches, they don't have to be federal employees.
The other half of the subtitle of your book, Tear Down Glen Canyon Dam. Mm-hmm. So why Glen Canyon Dam? Is it symbolic in some ways, or is it just sort of literally the best example of a dam that needs to go?
I think it's the best example of a very symbolic dam. The question is, why do we have a dam at Glen Canyon, and what is its purpose? Glen Canyon Dam was built on faulty assumptions. It was the result of political wheeling and dealing in the 1940s and 50s by a very small number of people. And I don't think that the people who agreed to support it understood exactly what the costs would be associated with constructing it. We have flooded one of the most beautiful places on the face of the earth, Glen Canyon. It's a magnificent area. And it continues to be partially flooded by Lake Powell. And the question is, why do we keep Glen Canyon Dam? We don't market any water out of there. The amount of power that's produced has been reduced by a third because of the drought. We no longer produce peaking power from it. There are ample alternatives to the hydroelectric power generated at Glen Canyon. So we don't need the water. We don't need the power. The reservoir itself is less than half empty. It's about 44% of capacity. Hoover Dam downstream is also around 45% capacity. My feeling is if we don't need Glen Canyon Dam anymore, we ought to remove it. We ought to bypass, move water downstream, fill Lake Mead, and market the water to the lower basin states in Mexico and generate power from Hoover Dam. So we know that the system, because of climate change and the drought, we know that going forward, we're going to have less water and it's going to come at a different time and in different forms than it has in the past. So it could well be that the structures that we've built, the system that we've built for collecting and moving water, will have to be abandoned. And I think Glen Canyon will be part of that process. A lot of smaller dams will become irrelevant or won't work. And I think we're going to have to make some hard decisions going forward.
In places like Utah, where we depend on snowpack, we have natural frozen reservoirs, basically. We know that we're going to be getting more rain and less snow, and we're not going to be able to rely on those sort of natural reservoirs. Do we need to build reservoirs to capture that water? Do we need to rethink how we're talking about water usage in light of what you just said about climate change and these big changes that are happening? How do we reimagine that whole water infrastructure? Because we talk about the snowpack as sort of preserving our water for when we need it.
Yeah.
How else do we do that?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is do exactly what you said, which is to rethink things. Traditionally, we have said that the way to solve a water supply problem is to build a reservoir. But the reality is reservoirs are not terribly efficient. Evaporation is a real problem. Leakage is a real problem. And it's a very inefficient way of delivering water. But it's what we've always done, so we're going to continue to do it. But we need to look at underground storage. We need to look at conjunctive use of surface water and groundwater. We need to manage our groundwater better. We need to promote conservation. We need to look at the way we price water so we price it in a way that helps promote conservation. There are thousands of things that we need to do going forward to look at things in a different way. We have to really look for creative, innovative ways of addressing these problems.
Well, you talk about reservoirs as a potential solution to a water supply problem, but we also have water demand problems, it seems like. I mean, if we're going to talk about where are we going to get the water from, we first need to ask, what do we need all of that water for? And you address conservation, water conservation in the book as a solution or an alternative to the water problems that we have. We talk about residential conservation, that we're, you know, supposed to put in low-flow toilets and Xeriscape and all of these things, and we can make huge cutbacks in our water usage at home. It makes a big difference. But from my understanding, in Utah and other Western states, 85% of our water is being used for agriculture. I haven't really heard anybody talk about conservation on that bigger scale. Like, we know what our personal responsibility is to conserve water. What's agriculture and industry's responsibility?
Well, if water is delivered to agriculture at subsidized rates, free in some cases, or very low rates, what's the incentive for them to do anything? And the short answer is there is none. So what we need to do is eliminate the subsidies that we place on water, and that can be done through our tax system or some other way. But there is no doubt that we need to promote water conservation and efficient use in agriculture, and that's where we would have the most dramatic and the biggest payoff. Just a 10% increase in the efficiency or reduction in the use of water for agriculture would meet the needs for municipal and industrial water purposes in just about every state in the West. So we're not talking about a big, it's not a heavy lift. The challenge is to encourage farmers and irrigation districts to be creative and to be innovative and to reduce their consumption of water. And that's very difficult to do at this point because all the incentives work in the other direction.
Is there anything worth keeping from the current federal water management system as headed by the Bureau of Reclamation? If we were going to abolish it, is there something? What would you run back into the burning building and save? If
I think there are a lot of very bright and talented young people who work on ecosystem management and restoration in the Bureau. And they will find a home working for either state or local governments or other federal agencies, EPA, Department of Agriculture, and others. I think the level of expertise that the Bureau has built up over the years in restoring ecosystems and working on some of the environmental problems associated with operating their facilities has been pretty remarkable. And I think that those folks, I'm confident, won't have any trouble finding a job and getting a paycheck.
Dan Beard, former commissioner of the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation and author of Deadbeat Dams, thank you for taking the time to write the book and for talking to me and for sharing your ideas.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here.
There are two stories about beaver coming up. You'll probably want to stay tuned after this short break. This is The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. Undammed rivers and streams in their natural states are free to move. They sometimes spread out beyond their banks, and they occasionally or even regularly flood. This wild, seemingly unpredictable behavior is healthy for rivers, and it keeps the fish and birds and amphibians and even the people who need the river healthy. A lot of our rivers here in Utah and throughout the West are not wild, and many are not healthy. They've been dammed to store water or to make electricity. They've been funneled through culverts and forced underground so we can drive over them. They've been left exposed to grazing cattle that trample and erode their banks. When rivers are restricted or channelized, they start to cut deeper and deeper into the earth. They don't spread out. They don't flood. They're controlled for various purposes, but they're not healthy. Wildlife biologists and geologists who study rivers and streams are tasked with making rivers healthy again by letting them return to their natural, wild, and messy state. They've enlisted the help of experts, rodent experts, to help with the job. Ross Chambliss has this story about what beavers do so well and how we can learn from them.
Joe Wheaton has taken me to the edge of a stream called Temple Fork here in the headwaters of the Logan River. Wheaton is a fluvial geomorphologist at Utah State University. That means he basically studies how water shapes and changes the land. Wheaton says this riparian area was badly damaged from many years of unchecked cattle grazing and reckless campers, but he wants me to see what beavers have since done here.
This is on the main stem here of Temple Fork. In 2009, there was nothing here all the way up to the fall. Over a period of probably 2 to 3 weeks, we think. So they built that first draft of the dam, and then the next fall they came back and then raised it up to its elevation here, which spread water all the way out, all around over there. And then that dam sort of persisted. It didn't breach even in the 2011 floods. It's been around ever since, but last year, we're not sure exactly when, but somebody came and just shot him.
Just shot him, he says. Murdered him. Beavers get killed a lot, Wheaton says, just for, well, being beavers. I can see the pained frustration in his face. This same dam-building rodent that he's enamored with is also vilified by some who see the buck-toothed mammal as a pest. And it's true, beavers cut down lots of trees. They can also build dams that flood roads and property. Sometimes farmers and ranchers even think beavers steal their water.
Well, it's an unfortunate name that we give these things and call them dams, because as humans, we think of dams as these big impermeable water storage, you know, facilities. And with a beaver dam, if you walk back and look at that, or you just walk back and listen to it, it's a porous mess, right? And so this is a big leaky sponge. And so what really happens here is, you know, a better way to think of it is, if you want to think of it as a reservoir more like your snowpack, is you get a bunch of water storage here, and then you get the slow release of that water over time. So beaver can't create water or destroy water or take water away. They don't drink that much. But what they can do is create these temporary storage, you know, sort of zones that then slowly release that out over time. So if you're an irrigator downstream, and it's really important to you to have a lot of water in, say, May or June, when you already have a lot of water, then maybe this is a problem. But if you're an irrigator that maybe wants water when it's getting really hot in August or September, this might actually help.
Beavers build dams that are temporary. Eventually, all beaver dams get abandoned or blown out or sometimes blown up with dynamite. But Wheaton says what matters most is what the dams leave behind. Beaver dams capture sediment that creates complicated habitat, often ideal for amphibians, fish, and countless other creatures that depend on healthy streams.
But there's a big misconception with the deposits in these dams that, you know, they're just filled with nothing but the fine sediment. And that is good that beaver dams could be a sink for that fine sediment that may be a water quality problem. But if you look at just what we see right here, I mean, there's actually, those look like gorgeous spawning gravels in there if you're, say, a cutthroat trout. And we also see a lot of organics and wood mixed in. Some of that's the material that they've used in the winter to build up their food cache. So they'll actually sort of put sticks on the bottom, let them get waterlogged, and then that's what'll sustain them as this freezes over in the winter. They can harvest that material that they stored up in the fall in a food cache. And so these deposits have a lot more mixed, you know, they're not just fines, they're coarse material like gravels and this wood. And so when this dam goes away, this isn't just this big source now of sediment that is going to be released. It's this much more complex deposit that leaves behind it much more complicated habitat. And a lot of this stuff stays here, and it slowly builds up these valleys. And a lot of the valleys that we see in these small little tributaries, the valley bottoms themselves are largely a product of beaver dams over time, just building these surfaces up.
Wow.
As Wheaton explains these things, I'm beginning to understand his enthusiasm, his passion about beavers and the dams they build. These tiny creatures are actually capable of repairing the ecosystems of whole entire river valleys. We're with some of his research colleagues, and with our fishing waders strapped on, we're walking further up to Spawn Creek, another tributary that's a protected spawning stream for native cutthroat trout. About 10 years ago, the U.S. Forest Service decided to protect this area after overgrazing from cattle had eroded stream banks so much that fish populations were dwindling. Since then, with the cattle kept out and the beavers left alone to build their dams, the fish populations have flourished. Wheaton says this place perfectly illustrates how beavers can help restore damaged streams across the West. That's why he's helped to develop a Beaver Restoration Assessment Tool, or BRAT for short, that is now helping to predict where beavers will likely build dams on streams across the whole state of Utah. Wheaton says his own conversion to Beaver Believer came from witnessing the futility of some conventional restoration projects.
I got involved initially just in stuff that was essentially stream bank stabilization to protect private property that was being called restoration.
And what's involved with that? Kind of
basically trying to stabilize banks, but then instead of maybe doing it with riprap, they'd do it with more natural, you know, materials, you know, so you might use sort of erosion control blankets and lay the banks back and that sort of stuff, or you might just try and get the banks planted with a bunch of riparian veg. Then we were doing a lot of what was called spawning habitat restoration, downstream of dams. So not beaver dams, but big, huge water reservoirs. They not only hold back water, they also block the delivery of sediment from the upper watershed. And so not all sediment's bad. Mm. If you're a salmonid, you need nice, clean spawning gravels to spawn in. And so those gravels are also locked up behind these dams. And so what people would do is they would dump gravel back downstream of the dam. And so we came up with a bunch of ways to, instead of just dumping it and hoping it sort of reformed and good habitat, where we'd actually build spawning habitat.
I see.
And so this is all what I like to call Tonka toy restoration. So where we, you know, with all our confidence and engineering arrogance, we go out and we think, yep, we know what's best for the river, and we're going to go and fix this and try and make it better.
Uh-huh. And, so, and you say Tonkatoy because a lot of it involves large machinery.
Yeah, it's all with, so with this, it was, you know, using front-end loaders and excavators and whatnot to place material in the channel. In a lot of cases, people are using those same sort of Tonkatoys to even build new channels. And so you have maybe a straightened sort of degraded channel, and then they'll go, you know, build a perfect sine curve or something and a nice little meandering channel off the side. There's been a lot of criticism by restoration scientists of those sorts of approaches as being too prescriptive, too form mimicry, and instead wanting to let the river do the work and let natural processes sort of shape the river. And you're much better in the long term if you can come up with a restoration strategy that relies less on us and our judgment and more on the river sort of building the habitat.
Across Utah, the state's Division of Wildlife Resources spends millions of dollars each year on what Wheaton would call Tonkatoy restoration. Aside from being expensive, the big problem that Wheaton sees is that few restoration projects receive much follow-up or monitoring after a project is finished to verify whether the efforts are truly making streams healthier.
Well, to a certain degree, that's correct. We are having a hard time coming up with a metric to actually monitor. I mean, because we're in the business of fish management for the most part.
This is Kent Sorensen.
Okay, I'm Kent Sorensen. I'm currently working in the Division of Wildlife Resources Northern Region as the Assistant Habitat Manager, which basically entails a lot of riparian restoration work.
Currently, the DWR say they are working with federal, state, and other local partners on over 50 stream restoration projects statewide.
And as a division, we're really good at doing. We can grab money, make a project, do a project, but our constituency base kind of expects us to go on to the next one and do another one and do another one. They're not as concerned about, did what you do make a difference? Because they see a difference. It's manifested in this hole where I never used to be able to catch fish, now I can catch fish. So they're satisfied with a change. Now, whether that change is significant or not, we don't get a chance to go back and look because we're on to the next project.
As Sorensen alludes to, the state mainly looks at fish habitat for gauging a healthy stream. For example, the state admission of the division's Blue Ribbon Fisheries Advisory Council works to improve Utah's streams for the enjoyment of anglers. They spend over $250,000 a year on stream restoration work. About one-fifth of that goes towards monitoring. And they say the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the Division of Water Quality, and the Environmental Protection Agency are increasingly requiring more in-depth and long-term assessments in the future. Still, Sorensen concedes that the metric of only keeping anglers happy may be too myopic for understanding the overall health of most streams.
When you do the heavy equipment types of restoration, it's satisfying in one way because you can walk away at the end of the week and say, look, I've changed this river course, I've made better habitat, and now we're on to the next one. Well, what you don't know is if you really did any good. It appears that you might have done some good, but you may not have. But, you know, we're learning, and some of the things we've done, I'm pretty confident that we've hit a home run on. Some of the things we've done, I'm pretty confident we, you know, need to go back to the drawing board.
So you're probably asking, what does any of this have to do with beavers? Well, a few years ago, Utah DWR produced one of the most progressive beaver management plans in the West. The same agency that for decades commonly turned to lethal removal to deal with beavers now treats the animal as a valued tool for stream restoration. Sorensen says beavers and their Tonkatoys are just different tools in the same box.
You know, high water can sometimes cause, you know, obvious damage to a river course. And we're expected to address that. The heavy equipment approach is probably more appropriate there. It's a spot approach. It doesn't really have a lot of linear mileage to it that you can actually do with the types of budgets we get to work with. And it's quickly available to address a problem, a discrete problem. So yes, we still do that. But now you get into an area that's a more of a headwater type of a situation where it's not appropriate to bring heavy equipment in. It's either a long ways away from a population center, it's in a low conflict area for beaver, and get them in an area where they can excel at what they do, then they're completely appropriate. They address those incision problems that our rivers have. They bring the grade back up by trapping the sediment behind their dams. They work 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. They don't need a Corps of Engineers 404 permit. They just do your job for you.
Still, pretty much everyone agrees beavers work best in the headwaters, high in the mountains, far away from where people live and travel. Again, here's Joe Wheaton.
So it's going to be probably smaller systems, like these tributaries that we're up in, where they can actually build dams. And so we're, and oftentimes that's going to correspond with a lot of these areas that are, you know, whether they're managed by the Forest Service or BLM or whatnot, that are higher up in the system. And there are certainly places lower down, and valleys, but it's oftentimes there's more potential for sort of conflict with other land uses. And so, you know, beaver may cut down trees you don't want them to cut down, or they may clog culverts, or they may cause flooding. And so it's not to say that they can't be used as a restoration agent in those situations, but just requires a bit more planning and careful thinking, whereas up here, you know, there are certainly situations where it really can be as simple as just either letting them recover on their own or just bringing beaver back to a stream that doesn't have beaver right now.
So it's in places like this, the headwaters of the Logan River, where Wheaton thinks there's wisdom in leaving the dam building to the beavers, what he calls process-based restoration. He hopes this approach to stream restoration will catch on and in the long run will result in streams that are healthy not just for fish, but indeed for the entire biota of our rivers. For The Source, I'm Ross Chambliss.
Ross did some hiking and got to wear waders for his beaver story. My beaver assignment was a little less adventurous.
Really good quality beaver habitat for, you know, thousands of years.
There's like five grocery carts.
I head to the wetlands in the Walmart parking lot when The Source continues. The story takes place at a Walmart parking lot. I'm here this morning because I wanted to hear the origin story behind this pretty remarkable collaboration I've been following between university biologists, city engineers, Walmart stores, the Utah Conservation Corps, a family of beavers, and Dan Miller. Dan Miller co-founded the Bear River Watershed Council, a nonprofit conservation group. This all started when Dan was doing what nonprofit conservation group board members do. He was volunteering at a community event.
A lot of young children coming in. We had a little activity where the kids could make little beaver tails and then tie it to themselves. And then we had a stuffed beaver there that they could pet, and they could see we had some trees that had been gnawed through. And for me, it was just a crazy day. I mean, it never stopped. Just like groups of kids after groups of kids. And when I finally had to take a break and just pull myself away, I walked over to another booth that they were painting little small rocks as beaver. And it's, same kind of thing. And so I started talking to the person behind that booth, and it was Cammie from Walmart. And we're just talking about beaver, and she goes, well, you know, I'm kind of sad because we have beaver on our property, and the previous manager hired trappers to come in and kill them. And my jaw just dropped. It's like, what?
Cammie Hipwell is the store manager at the South Logan Walmart Supercenter. A small tributary of the Logan River called Spring Creek runs through the parking lot of Cammie's store, and there's essentially an untouched little wetland area in the corner of what can only be described as the most un-wetland place on Earth. And it's home to a thriving beaver pond complex.
I had been studying and reading up on beaver and how they benefit watersheds. And so I knew there were different ways to deal with beaver. And I told Cammy this. I go, there's better ways. You don't have to be exterminating them.
And Dan Miller knew who to call. A team of researchers at Utah State University's Department of Watershed Sciences who specialize in helping people and companies like Walmart live with beaver.
My name's Elijah Portugal, and I'm a geomorphologist with the Fluvial Habitat Center at Utah State University. And I do a variety of work mostly related to beaver. So we, you know, design, plan, and implement beaver-assisted restoration projects.
So this is your first Walmart job?
This is my first Walmart job. I never thought I'd be spending as much time as I have down here at Walmart, but yeah, they've been great. We've been very, very happy to be working with these guys, and just feel really good about the fact that they are interested in trying to do a more progressive form of beaver management.
When Elijah Portugal and his team work with clients like Walmart, they start at the beginning. They actually have a flowchart called, "So You Think You Have a Beaver Problem." It's not actually called that, but they do have a flowchart. For Elijah, it's important to know if the, quote, beaver problem is an actual problem or a perceived problem.
You know, you start out up here saying, okay, is this dam actually causing harm? If it's not causing harm, then you ask, does it have the potential to cause harm in the future? And if the answer is no, then you just say, you just leave it alone, and you kind of exit this conceptual figure here.
You still get paid.
So if a dam is actually causing harm, and that harm could be, is typically flooding or, backing water up into a culvert or, you know, somewhere where it shouldn't go. So then you ask, can those dam impacts be mitigated in some kind of way?
In Walmart's case, the beaver dams are causing harm. They're working on chewing down some pretty big trees that could fall on cars in the parking lot, and the stream backs up behind the beaver dams and floods the parking lot and potentially a busy state highway next to it.
So earlier, let's see, maybe 5 or 6 months ago, this dam, the largest dam in the dam complex, was really high. The beaver had built it up to probably a meter and a half to almost 2 meters tall. And when it was at that tallest height, it backed water all the way up through this area here. I'm kind of pointing over to part of the wetland area that is not actually underwater right now, but that pond extent was a little bit too big. So that was basically when the city decided that they needed to notch that one big dam because the pond was just getting too big.
Until Elijah's team got involved, the problem was being dealt with by the city of Logan periodically destroying the beavers and their dams. But the beavers just kept coming back.
This area, yeah, it's been great beaver habitat for thousands of years, and it still is now, obviously. I know that Walmart, over the 6 or 7 years that they've been here, they've had to have beaver trapped out of here at least 3 or 4 times. It might be more like half a dozen times. I'm not exactly sure about that. But yeah, there's no reason to expect that beaver will not continue to use this area. You know, it's connected to the Logan River, so they have access moving upstream, you know, up the Logan and then up Spring Creek here.
Elijah's proposed beaver management plan has a couple of strategies for balancing the needs of Walmart, the city, and the beavers to protect habitat while also protecting public and private property. And the plan isn't terribly complicated. The most high-tech part of the solution is installing something called a pond leveler.
It's a simple solution. You just put a tube through the dam at the level that you want it, and then you protect the tube so the beavers can't plug it up.
So basically it makes the dam permeable. So the dam stays?
The dam stays.
But the water goes through it.
Right, at a certain level that it's been determined from the survey that Elijah had provided.
Dan Miller gets it, and he's the conservation guy, remember, not the fluvial geomorphologist. Elijah Portugal's team wants to make beaver management plans that are based on common sense and easy to follow. One of the components of the Walmart plan, for instance, is to put a giant ruler in the pond so anyone can go out and see if the pond leveler is working.
And so that should be a pretty simple, kind of straightforward way to do that monitoring.
That would be such a great job for the when they come get the carts.
You know, yeah, right.
Like for the kid who comes and picks up the carts. While you're out there, go look at the ruler.
Yeah.
Check it out.
Where is the water on the ruler? Is it at the red line yet, or is it approaching the red line? I mean, that's really that's the way to get these kind of management plans to work, is you got to make it just easy for people to do.
Trying to get rid of the beavers entirely is expensive, exhausting, and pretty much fruitless. But adaptive beaver management, or living with beaver, has benefits to water quality and habitat for a host of other animals.
You know, they can cause problems, and, you know, certain times of year, if you were to walk out here and just look around, you'd be like, oh, they're just making a mess, you know. But that mess is really what rivers need to be functional. You know, it really, the messiness matters. You know, the more water that we can retain in wetland areas like this through beaver dams, the more benefits we're going to have to other critters, you know, so birds, other muskrats like the one we just saw, amphibians, reptiles. The riparian area itself benefits a lot from these elevated water levels. And then just from our human perspective, we benefit from having more fresh water maintained in wetland areas and higher up in small streams like this throughout the year, because that water retention is really important for maintaining good water temperature, as well as just providing more fresh water higher up in the watershed.
I tell Elijah that I don't know if humans actually learned to build dams from beavers, but it does seem like they serve a similar purpose. I like the idea that we may have been inspired by beavers when we started messing with our river systems to benefit our settlements.
It's true, and really, they do it a lot better than we do. And a dam like Glen Canyon Dam obviously serves a really different purpose than a bunch of small beaver dams, but really, you know, by having a lot of beavers in watersheds in the small streams within the headwaters portions of those watersheds, basically the more water that we can retain up there, that means the more water we're going to have further down in the watershed later on. And their dams are not completely impermeable. Beaver dams in most places really don't seem to block fish passage. So that's a huge problem with conventional man-made dams, is the fish passage issue. And beaver dams don't really seem to have the same problems. And that's mainly because, you know, they're made out of mud and sticks, and they're never completely impervious. So small fish can wriggle through. And during high flows, bigger fish can jump up and over dams or go around them when there's water flowing out around the dams onto the floodplain. And we've shown that really definitively in a few different places where we've been working with beaver to do restoration.
This is the big picture. This is why Elijah Portugal spends his days studying beavers and writing up adaptive beaver management plans for places like Walmart.
But yeah, in this era of drought in the West, I think a lot more water managers are starting to think about the role that beaver have played historically and can play now in helping to mitigate against some of these drought problems that we're having and that we will likely to continue to have in the future as we move forward with climate change.
Dan Miller of the Beaver Watershed Council is also a proponent of larger scale beaver reintroduction and adaptive management throughout the West. But he's especially keen on keeping the beavers here, in the South Logan Walmart Superstore parking lot. And he wants the project to include some interpretive signs for customers and visitors, especially the RV campers that are allowed to park here overnight in this corner of the parking lot.
It was fate that I bumped into the Walmart manager, and I was just open and listening, and I was glad I could be there, and it's exciting.
For our last story this hour, I talked to someone kind of unpopular in some circles. It's nothing personal. It's because, despite what Dan Beard has to say in Deadbeat Dams, and despite what the fluvial geomorphologists have to say about letting beavers get our rivers all messy, the state of Utah is planning on building a series of reservoirs on the Bear River in the coming years. I was actually really curious to talk to the person responsible for planning new dams in northern Utah, and a little bit nervous. The Bear River in northern Utah is like a bright star in Utah's uncertain water future. It's a big river, the largest river in the U.S. that doesn't reach the ocean. It contributes nearly 1 million acre-feet of fresh water every year to the Great Salt Lake. And it's stayed relatively underdeveloped because we haven't really needed it. Some of its waters are used for agriculture in northern Utah, but a lot of it still reaches the Great Salt Lake, entering at the Bear River Migratory Bird Refuge and providing the bulk of the fresh water in the lake. The population of Utah is projected to double by 2060, and state water managers have known for a long time that they would need to use the water from the Bear eventually. In the 1960s, the Bear River Compact divvied up the river's water between three states it flows through, Wyoming, Idaho, and Utah. In 1991, the Bear River Development Act tasked the Utah Division of Water Resources with developing the infrastructure needed to start marketing the water, and they divvied up Utah's share of the Bear between the affected counties and water conservation districts. The Bear River Development Act essentially reserved 220,000 acre-feet per year for future Utahns. Now it's someone's job to figure out how to develop that water. Develop is a very broad term, but think of it this way. Someone has to figure out how to get 220,000 acre-feet, or 1 trillion gallons, out of the river and into people's homes each year. Think pipes and pipelines, reservoirs and dams. Think about keeping everybody happy. All in all, the project is expected to cost $1.5 billion. It sounds like a really hard job.
It's definitely interesting. There's just no silver bullet.
Marisa Egbert is the project manager for the Bear River Development Project. She's been working on the project for the Utah Division of Water Resources for several years, but she's quick to point out that this project isn't even really a project yet. It's a plan. Well, it's not even really a plan.
Right now, we're doing a feasibility study. We are looking into formulating and looking into a plan on how to potentially develop that water. Right now, the projections that we're seeing is that we start needing some of the water from the Bear River Development Project around 2035 or 2040. So we're 20 to 25 years out before a first drop of water would possibly be needed on this project.
The current feasibility study doesn't get into details about the impact of climate change, but Egbert is well aware of the fact that there are huge fluctuations in stream flow on the Bear. There have been historically, and there will be in 2060 and beyond.
And that is part of where the reservoirs and the idea of the reservoirs helps in being able to manage some of that fluctuation in the stream flow.
The plan is not just for reservoirs. The three-pronged strategy for developing the Bear includes conservation, optimization, and expansion. Reservoirs and pipelines are considered expansion, and optimization entails fixing infrastructure and being innovative with what is already in place.
Conservation is a huge key in this process, and that is something that citizens in Utah, they've been doing a great job so far. Definitely that is something that has got to continue. Conservation's got to be a part of the Utah water user's ethic.
Dam is technically a three-letter word, but for a lot of people in northern Utah, their reaction would make more sense if it was four. I asked Egbert what she could say to calm people down who are really resistant or even afraid of the thought of damming the Bear.
Most Utahns rely on reservoirs. You know, with our climate and the way it is, when the water arrives is not necessarily when we need it. And if you think about a reservoir, you know, one way to look at it is it's a bank. There's times when things are plentiful and you can put some deposits into that bank. And then when things are dry, you can make some withdrawals out of that bank. There definitely are impacts that come from dams. But if you look at that as a bank, that is definitely a way to ensure the water supply for the future. We know the concerns that people have. You know, that's part of what we're trying to do in this study is trying to figure out the best plan and the best way to plan for this projected growth.
In some ways, nothing is set in stone, except for the Bear River Development Act, which is a law. But the project is already behind schedule, or at least the state is not where it thought it would be when the act was signed in 1991. Egbert says that conservation has had an impact on pushing the project back.
It'll definitely have an impact. We've already seen the project be pushed out. I can't say that the project would go away completely. That is not something we're seeing. Again, there's there's going to be growth even beyond a doubling of the population. There's just no silver bullet. There's no golden ticket.
Marisa Egbert, she's a project manager with the Utah Division of Water Resources. She's trying to figure out the best way to develop the Bear River in northern Utah as a source of water for a rapidly growing population. It's not an easy job. The Source comes from the studios of Utah Public Radio, a service of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University. I produce it with a lot of help from Ryan Cunningham. We get major support from iUtah. Our theme song was written and played so beautifully by Megan Simper. Special thanks to Source reporter Ross Chambliss and all of our guests, Dan Beard, Joe Wheaton, Kent Sorensen, Dan Miller, Elijah Portugal, and Marisa Egbert. There's a new episode of The Source every single month. The next one airs May 29th at 9 a.m. right here on Utah Public Radio. Listen to previous episodes at upr.org and find out what I'm working on by following me on Twitter. I'm at Year of Jen. The hashtag for the show is UPR Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. Thank you for listening.